Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
So we now have about 20 minutes for open discussion. Please, would you wait for the microphone before speaking and then stand up so that the television cameras can see you and give your name and organisation before asking a question. And for those of you looking in online, please use the submit question to chair button on your screen. So, questions. Go ahead.
Okay, my name's Ian Harvey. I'm from the University of East Anglia. Two questions, if I may. Nick, the figure you showed on the socioeconomic participation rate stratified by A-level attainment, those data presumably predate 9K fees. Do you think that the pattern will remain the same thereafter? And the second question to Paul and Nick, I think, given the RAB charge and the fiscal incontinence you referred to about student loans, do you think the student loan company could be smarter about trying to retrieve some of that cost? It is, in my experience as an end user, a parent, a fairly clunky organisation.
What the evidence shows is that the new higher fees don't appear to have any effect on demand. However, I've said there is an excess demand for places, and if there were more places, one would need to look. But certainly what the evidence suggests, I mean, pub economics says it's the price that matters and nothing else matters. And what I'm saying is, I'm not saying price doesn't matter at all. I mean, an economist couldn't stand up in public and get away with saying that. But over the range of price change that we observe, that effect is small, and it's the other stuff that one needs to do the heavy lifting on widening participation. But of course, one needs to have a look at the effect of higher fees. Could the student loans company be smarter in collecting repayments? There's two issues. Given the system, could the student loans company do a better job? I have no doubt the answer is yes, and that would be a good thing. But even if the student loans company were utterly perfect, the system itself is flawed, so that even if they collected 100% of what they were meant to collect, there would still be a loss as measured by the RAB charge, and there is a lot of good work saying that the RAB charge is significantly over-optimistic. So I think there's two problems. Student loans company operation could and should be improved, but the design of student loans should be improved as well.
I think that's right. I think on that second point, in the context of the design of the system and the sort of fiscal issues that are being faced, I think recovery of debt is an issue, but it's a relatively small one. I think there are two other things. So one is that there's a wider question about the role of the student loans company. Now, it's a huge player in the system, and it's very operationally focused at the moment, and I think one of the points about getting into the detail of the regulatory environment, what is the role of the loans company going to be in influencing public policy, and what's going to happen with all the loan debt that it's holding. So there are bigger questions, I think, around the loans company. I think on your first question around socioeconomic group, I mean, I'm bound to say it's too early to tell. I think that we may, when we're reviewing what's happened in 2012-13, when we get to sort of the end of this year or January 2013 and looking at the patterns of decision-making, I would anticipate that grade is still the most significant factor influencing entry to university. It may be potentially that the situation where the categories of students with the highest social capital have the more sophisticated decision-making, and that may influence the pattern of distribution of student numbers that ends up. And I think that points up, again, the importance of this question around information and data and removing that asymmetry.
There's a question here.
Hello. My name is Keith Herman. I'm Director of Higher Ed Research. There's much talk in the policy discourse about this issue of higher-level skills. But I'm somewhat concerned about the big black hole that is the skills debate. And in particular, I guess, the division between higher education and further education. What steps do you think we can take to promote greater collaboration between universities and colleges, particularly in terms of ensuring a credit framework that works on a national basis, that can then take up, you know, and improve participation through further education, then into higher education, to address the realities that a little-known report made some projections around the 2020 workforce, you know, being those people still at work, otherwise known as the Leech Report. You know, so the reality is that in terms of the numbers of people participating in higher education, there are clearly opportunities around part-time studies, and yet with a new system in place, there is some research that shows that the numbers of people participating in part-time study are actually going to go down as a result of the new reform. So any comments and suggestions, welcome.
Well, but very quickly, I think the first thing would be to ideally design a policy framework which doesn't set different parts of the sector against each other. So it's not a question of either or. You know, we have to face the reality. We are currently in a period, and likely to be in a period, where there are scarce resources to be allocated, and that's always going to lead to those kind of either or questions. And I think that collectively, all parts of the system and the sector working to design policies and policy proposals which can overcome those kind of binary divides, I think are going to be is going to be an essential step. And I would say that we need more of both. We need more highly skilled, and we need more skills across, you know, the range of the workforce in order to be competitive in the future.
Actually, Nick, I mean, I agree with everything you said, Keith. I mean, we know from evidence from the US that actually one of the really significant ways of tackling making and widening participation really work is getting young people, older people, whoever, into community colleges, and actually then getting that articulation, that connection between those community colleges through to those top-level universities. And there is an abundance of evidence about that. And I think that was the kind of thing that actually, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, when David Willetts started talking about further education, you know, there was talk of community colleges and whatever here. And as Paul has said, you know, we've gone exactly against that. But of course, one of the reasons is, as Nick started off with, you know, we have a capped number of students. So in the US, where there is no student number cap, doesn't make the system that more affordable. But actually, you can have the benefits of competition, but without that constrained number. Whilst we retain a student number cap here, any decrease in you know, numbers for traditional universities to go into the FE sector creates these kind of tensions that it's very difficult for another policy driver, which may be widening participation, to overcome.
All of this is wrapped up in politics of further education, of course. I mean, a number of universities with long-standing partnerships with further education colleges realise through sharing of numbers and direct and indirect funding and so on, are now stepping back from that and taking those numbers off the further education colleges. It's not happening quite as widespread as sometimes David Willetts makes it out to be, and certainly my institution, University of East London, we've decided not to do that. We have a different view, and we are, certainly for the time being, holding on to our further education partners. However, it is just the case that when you look around the country, two things are happening which I've written about, which are a concern to me. First of all, a number of institutions have been given additional level 3 further education places, as well as higher education places, have a historical track record of not recruiting to the numbers they have in the first place. Right? So let's be honest about this. Secondly, issue around part-time students, it just is the case that the two biggest constituencies, part-time students are an area where, in some respects, many of them do get a good deal in the future, but the numbers are absolutely appalling for 2012. There's no question about it, and that's a real worry to me. We do know the student loan company struggles to get clear and comprehensible information out to people who want to come into higher education, and I suspect, though I have no direct evidence, that when students want to do an HE programme on a part-time basis in an FE college, phoning up SLC at Glasgow could be a very difficult gig.
I mean, where we are at the moment is, in a way, a policy so clever that it achieves not a single desirable objective. Student numbers are capped, so HE institutions and FE institutions compete like ferrets in a sack for a fixed number of students, which is craziness number one. Craziness number two because student loans are so expensive, they're rationed. Availability in further education is very limited. There are no loans for UK postgraduate students, which has to be absolutely batty in terms of national economic performance. So clearly what needs to happen is relaxing the numbers cap, making student loans fiscally less expensive, and that way you can relax student numbers. You then need to make sort of credit exchange between FE and HE much more flexible. And then you start to have a sort of system that makes sense, because in my view, one shouldn't be thinking about FE and HE, one should be thinking about tertiary education. Mm. But at the moment, all the existing institutions militate against that. I think we have time for one more question. Aaron.
There's a steel question, but it's Aaron Porter. It's a very brief question. You've talked about making the student loan system more fiscally kind of acceptable. Is that crudely increasing the rate of interest once again, or how do you think you would go about doing that?
Okay. How does one make... Well, let's say, how would we make student loans cost nothing to the taxpayer in the long run? I mean, the taxpayer has to meet the cash flow cost. How do you make sure that all of it comes back? You need to do two things. First of all, you need to lower the threshold at which repayments start so that a larger fraction of graduates repay their loan in full in present value terms. Loans are a device for relaxing credit constraints. They are not a device for redistribution. There are much more powerful and much better instruments for redistribution. So student loans should be devised that most graduates, those with a reasonable career, repay their loan in full. If you do that, loans with income contingent repayments protect people with low monthly earnings, and forgiveness after 25 or 30 years protects graduates with low lifetime earnings. That loan system will make a loss on graduates with low lifetime earnings. It is designed to make that loss. It is well-targeted social spending. The question is, who should pay those costs? And at the moment, it's a taxpayer, but those costs could be imposed on the cohort of graduates through a cohort risk premium, which would mean a slightly higher rate of interest. It could also be put on universities through a university-specific insurance premium. And I've written with Neil Shepherd at Oxford that in a sensible system, you should have a mix of the two. So there would be possibly an extra 1% on the interest rate that graduates pay, and that would cover the loss on loans for fees up to, let's say, £7,500. Institutions that charged higher fees would have, at a university level, to pay an insurance premium. So ideally, that way, loans would cost the taxpayer nothing. In practice, you could say costs should be shared in some sensible way between the taxpayer, the cohort of graduates and universities. Do that, and you're motoring. Do we have time? Yeah, we have time for one more question. One more question? Any takers? Yeah, there's one back there.
Thank you. Bill McNeil from the College of Estate Management. You've spoken about the early years and the new students coming out of schools. You haven't said a great deal between you about mature students, and you have made some mention of postgraduate issues. There is evidence that the number of mature students looking for higher education is already declining, and there is speculation that the fees will have an impact on postgraduate uptake. Do you have any feeling as to where mature students and postgraduate education will go post 2015?
Because I did reference the importance about looking at people beyond the 18-year-old section, because I do think that gap between competence and performance is different. The recognised competence and the observed performance, and certainly in the US, as I say, they're hinging their growth on that 17% growth in people aged 26 to 29. But to answer your question directly, Bill, I think, first of all, there will be a 2 or 3 year period where mature students will be risk confused and will not engage with the system, and I think they will come back into the system at that point. I think this is a refractory period. It will not self-correct, but I'm confident that the energy in universities and elsewhere will make that happen. In terms of postgraduate, I think you're right in what you say. I think mature students are deterred from postgraduate work, but I think that a lot of people from underrepresented families are not getting into postgraduate programmes, and that again is part of the broader issue about the full harnessing of all of our talents in the country, and that does need to be addressed. And my very final point is, it is a degree of irony that mature students are actually, in the current system, one of the constituencies that get the most benefit because their lifetime earnings, the impact of the write-off deadline, and the fact that they've got a long period to get back into the workforce means they're the principal beneficiaries, or they, you know, in terms of the rank ordering of it, and yet those are the ones that are most deterred, which showed you just how important communication is in all of these changes.
I think that's absolutely right. I would agree with that. There's a tendency, I think, and somebody mentioned the this thing called the policy discourse, to think of students as 18-year-old students from England. And if you look at the data for 2012, the applications from that group of students are down by about 4%, 2% of which can be accounted for by demographics, but mature students is closer to 11%. So I think there is, you know, there is clearly an issue there. I would say two further things. One is that there are not a lot of other kind of substitution offers available at the moment, and so I would sort of endorse what Patrick has said about this correcting at some point in the future, but also that we lose a lot by narrowing our thinking, not just around university entrance, but around social mobility, and ignoring those who are already in the workforce. A substantial proportion of mature students, and that's why that we need to have again a policy framework which can really focus on meeting the needs of that part of the workforce and that part of the economy from both sides, from the supply and demand side of things.
And actually, just to finish on postgrads and bring it back to what Keith was saying about strategy. You know, we have no high level skills strategy in this country at all. You know, the previous government tried to do a little bit of it, and we never really got anywhere. The problem is that we have actually a completely unsustainable postgraduate market as we stand. So this is not actually about what may happen in future. What may happen in future makes things worse than they are now. So actually, a lot of the postgraduate market in this country at the moment in key sectors is actually completely underpinned by international student recruitment. But then you can flow that through. So if we have international student recruitment, we're actually desperate to get all these students to leave the country immediately, and yet actually a lot of our postgraduates in engineering and in chemistry and physics, but particularly in management, are all international students. So there's a genuine... If you go to the University of Cranfield and study their MBA, 86% of the students are international students. The remainder are home and EU. If you take the EU ones out, you get well below 10%. And that is replicated across a lot of the best MBAs in this country. Where simply are the talented, high-level, skilled people who are going into our companies, into those small companies, medium companies and big companies to push this country's economy forward? We need some kind of high-level skills strategy for which actually how we fund postgraduate students has to be part of that but cannot be the totality.
I mean, just briefly following on. I mean, when fees were introduced in 2006, there was a dip. There was a big spike in applications the year before as people cancelled gap years. A dip in 2006 and then back on trend. So trend, there was no effect. This time around, the dip has come mainly from mature students who are presumably in jobs, and this is a high-risk time to be leaving your job to go into higher education. So my hypothesis, and it's only a hypothesis, is that the trend will continue upwards, but the blip is the combination of an increase in fees during a recession. On postgraduates, what is it that stops people going to university? I've suggested it's liquidity constraints and constraints with earlier routes. The constraints with earlier routes are largely dealt with at an undergraduate level. So what you're left with at a postgraduate level are liquidity constraints, and not to have loans for UK postgraduates, as I've said, is batty. So that I agree it's only part of the story, but as I've said, finance is deeply boring, but you need to get it right to make all the other bits work. Well, let me, please may we end by thanking three speakers for three cracking good presentations.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.